Hello, everyone. Good afternoon. Welcome. Welcome to the Alaska World Affairs Council. Everyone found us in our location here on the second floor. We will be back up in the chart room for our next program in 2 weeks. If you could please take a moment to turn off your cell phones. This program is being recorded and will be on the KSKA website. And so if you could just check those to make sure they don't go off, that would be wonderful for our recording. My name is Lisa Falsco. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska World Affairs Council, and it's a pleasure to see so many people here today. I don't know if we have any students. It is finals week, but if you are a student, if you could please stand up and be recognized. Fantastic. Hope your finals are going great, and thank you so much to BP for sponsoring our student lunches and making it possible for the students to come to our programs. I'd also like to thank William and Michael for doing our recording today, and that, like I said, will be rebroadcast or shown on the KSKA website. At our head table, to my far left, is Keith Steinbaugh. He is the president of our board of directors. And to his right is Dr. Ted Kassir, who has a couple of hats, one with the university and one on our board of directors, and he will come up to introduce our speaker today. Ted.
Thank you, Lisa. Well, once again, it is my pleasure to appear before you to introduce a UAA colleague as a World Affairs Council luncheon speaker. This time it is our Chancellor, Fran Ulmer. The biography that you have had before you and that was posted with the program information on the World Affairs Council website and included with the program announcement is particularly complete, so I'll limit this introduction to just a few key updates. In addition to all that you can read about Fran, I need to add that she will be leaving the UAA chancellorship in just a few days, effective May 1st. And that, among other things, she will be stepping into a presidential appointment as chair of the Arctic Research Commission. As you all know, Fran was also appointed by the president as a member of the National Commission on the BP Deepwater Horizon oil spill and offshore drilling issues, which recently issued its report. Before turning the microphone over to Chancellor Ulmer, and itself also something of an update, I'd like to draw your attention to one particular item. UAA has been building its international relations and emphasizing study abroad. We had and have right now a number of students in Japan whom we have been tracking and looking out for. Fortunately, all of them safe in the context of Japan's recent catastrophic disaster. But a recent graduate who was teaching English in Japan was not so fortunate. Monty Dixon, UAA class of 2009, perished in the earthquake and ensuing flood in the town of Rikusa Tenkata. A scholarship's being created in Monty's memory to provide financial assistance to UAA students studying abroad in Japan, and a celebration of Monty's life will be held in this very hotel's Aleutian Alaska room, which I think are just down the hall, tomorrow at 3 p.m. We are all very sad about losing Monty, but know that he will endure through both the celebration and the scholarships that will go on for many years. Please consider contributing. Back to the business immediately at hand, Chancellor Ulmer has shared with me that her well-established interest in the Arctic had its genesis in her membership in a USO singing and dancing touring group when she was a senior at the University of Wisconsin, I guess while she was still an undergraduate, not while she was in law school, performing in Greenland, Iceland, Newfoundland, and Labrador. I don't think we'll see any of that today, only because of the limitations of time, but it does suggest that she truly has an extensive and long-standing background in this area. Her topic for us today is the Deepwater Horizon oil spill, lessons learned, and implications for Alaska and the Arctic. Please join me in welcoming UAA Chancellor Fran Ulmer.
Thank you very much, Ted, and thanks to the World Affairs Council for inviting me today. I see a lot of familiar faces in this audience, and it's nice to see you all here. I just want to warn you ahead of time that this is a two-hour lecture, which I'm going to give in about 40 minutes. So I say that only because there will be a number of slides that I just won't have time to spend much time with, and I will kind of pick and choose a few of these. But I do want to urge you, those of you who are particularly interested in this topic, that the website from the Oil Spill Commission, which is oilspillcommission.gov, is a great resource for additional information about the spill, about our recommendations, about the policy papers that were written by staff, and I encourage you to do that. Before I launch into this, I just want to give you a heads up about a couple of things I left at the front table that relate to UAA. Those of you who know me well know that it's impossible for me to go to an event without passing out things from UAA. It's just part of what I do. So I still get to do this. At the front desk, you will find a flyer about Classrooms for Climate. This is actually a fabulous event that will be held at UAA next week, a partnership between the Chugach Forest and UAA on climate change in the Chugach region. A complex systems flyer about an event that will also be at UAA next week, Managing Oil and Gas Risks in the Arctic Offshore, Emerging Perspectives. We have a couple of out-of-state folks who have spent a lot of time working on the question of risk management, and so there will be a panel on Tuesday night on that topic, and a one-pager, which is just kind of an update on things at UAA. So on your way out the door, grab a few of the flyers in case you are interested in any of those things, and I hope you are. So let me talk a bit of background about this experience that I had as a member of the commission. The commission was appointed shortly after the tragedy that took place on April 20th of last year, and we were given 6 months to complete our work. So we were appointed in late May, early June, and in mid-January, we delivered our report to the president in person at the White House, 6 months from when we were appointed. This made us a pretty unusual commission. We finished our work on time, under budget, and with a unanimous decision. When was the last time you heard of a commission doing anything like that? And let me just say, that was not easy, because setting up a commission, getting staff, interviewing witnesses, understanding the nature of the problem, coming up with recommendations, writing the report, editing it, publishing it, it was something that we're all very, very proud of. We held a lot of hearings, both in the Gulf of Mexico region and in Washington, D.C., and produced this report. Let me just say at the outset, our job was not to assign legal liability. We know there are plenty of lawsuits associated with that. What we were asked to do by the president was two things. Number one, look at the underlying root causes of this accident. And number two, make recommendations to make oil and gas drilling safer in the future. We were not asked to opine about national energy policy. We were not, there were a lot of things that we could have done. Some people wanted us to do, we didn't. We stayed focused on our mission and did, and I think, a good job. Let's take just a moment to remember what it is that happened on April 20th of last year. A terrible tragedy in which 11 men died, dozens were injured, approximately 200 million gallons of oil released into the Gulf. Literally billions of dollars have been spent on both the response, the payout to individuals, compensation, research funds, huge damage yet to really be understood completely in terms of environmental damage, damage to the economy of the region, seafood, tourism, support industry, the oil and gas industry itself, because of the moratorium which happened as a result of this spill. So big impacts. And although up here right now it doesn't feel like that, I mean, you may have noticed on the one-year anniversary, you know, some mention of it in the media, but not much. If you went to the Gulf states, you would still palpably feel the impacts associated with this tragedy. And the lingering effects, in some ways, that little tiny graph that you can't see very far talks about the emotional well-being of the people of the Gulf Coast as measured by things like suicide, depression, et cetera. The Gulf Coast on the left and other states that weren't impacted in the south. Those of you who were here during the Exxon Valdez oil spill, 1989, you will remember the long lingering emotional effects as well as physical and economic impacts. And that's certainly happening there, even though we don't feel it up here. I won't take a lot of time with this, but basically the key findings in terms of the causes of the explosion and the accident was that it really primarily related to lack of risk management and a lot of human error, a lot of decisions that were made that could have, should have, would have been done differently. The report goes into a lot of depth, which we do not have time for today, in terms of the decisions, the cement job, the inadequate reading of the negative pressure test results. We could spend a lot of time with this. Let me just say that, of course, hindsight is always 20/20. But if you analyze the decisions that were made by the multiple companies who were involved, by the decisions that were made both on the rig and at headquarters, one has to come to the conclusion that there's got to be a better way. There's got to be a better way of managing risk. There has to be a better way of preparing for accidents, of training workers, and of having mechanisms on board and on shore that can do a better job of protecting against the kind of human errors in judgment that were made associated with this incredible disaster. It wasn't just what happened on that rig or just those companies, however. It was also a failure in our regulatory regime to do what most Americans hope is being done, and that is that we are regulating in a way that protects against those kinds of disasters from happening. And of course, in a high-risk industry, there will always be accidents. The question is really what we can do, both industry and government, to minimize those risks and to reduce the problems associated with the accidents. There were a number of things that could have and should have been done by the federal agencies involved. And as we went through and tried to understand how the Minerals Management Service, MMS, which of course no longer exists, it has been reformulated, renamed, but how it came to be that MMS had become an entity, frankly, that had become quite complacent in a lot of ways, as unfortunately some of the industry has as well. I do want to say that it wasn't simply lack of will. It was also lack of resources. And this graph, just sort of in a shorthand way, shows you the rapid rate of increase of oil and gas activity in the Gulf of Mexico, both from the standpoint of number of wells, but also the volume of oil, and the way in which the budget for MMS was being cut, the number of inspections were being reduced, the kinds of inspections from pre-plan versus, you know, surprise inspections. There was a consistent pattern in terms of the inability of the agency that we all expected to be doing a good job of inspecting. They were not being given the resources or, in some cases, actually having the necessary expertise to keep pace with a very rapidly developing, technologically advanced industry, which is what, particularly in deep water, is the only way you can describe the OCS activities in the Gulf of Mexico. So we also did some comparisons in terms of the United States versus our peer nations that have sophisticated oil and gas in outer continental shelf development as well. Now, clearly, if you compare us to Nigeria, we look pretty good. If you compare us to Europe or Australia or Great Britain, we have things that we can learn from other countries. This just shows you that in the Gulf of Mexico, the fatality rate is four times as high as it is in the North Sea. And needless to say, the North Sea is a much more dangerous operating environment than the Gulf of Mexico is. So that brings up a lot of questions. There actually were 79 unintended blowout events in the Gulf of Mexico between 1996 and 2006. Now, those blowout events did not result in the kind of tragedy that happened at the Deepwater Horizon, but they could have, or some of them could have, depending upon exactly what the circumstances were. So we have all been kind of lulled into a false sense of security about the safety associated with the industry. I am not saying that there aren't safe operators. There are lots of them. What I am saying is that the culture of safety needs to be something that we keep front and center, both industry and government, and for the American people, frankly, because we own those resources. Let's just remember that the Outer Continental Shelf, that's a public resource. We lease them to be developed, but we have a fiduciary responsibility as the owner to make certain that everybody who is doing business there, whether they're in the private sector or the public sector regulators, have safety as their goal. So I took a moment to basically reflect a little bit on the differences between what happens in Norway, just as an example country, and the United States in terms of our regulatory regime. And I wish I had more time to take you through this, but there are a lot of differences, some of them subtle, some of them significant, some of them relating to the culture of our countries, the way in which we do business, some of them relating to simply what has evolved over time in this country as sort of a patchwork quilt of a lot of different agencies having a lot of different pieces of the regulatory regime as opposed to more focused effort in Norway. But I would say, in general, the approach that Norway uses, which we sometimes refer to as the safety case, versus the more prescriptive regulatory approach that is used in the United States, I believe is a fundamental difference in our being able to manage risk more effectively if we learn from Norway. And what do I mean by that? And I'll just take a pause. When I say safety case, in Norway and in other countries that use that approach, each individual well, each individual rig, and the companies that are doing business on that rig. And let's remember, on a particular rig, like the Deepwater Horizon, for example, you may have dozens of companies coming together to work as a team on that rig. It's not one company, it's not two companies, it's often a dozen of companies, contractors, and subcontractors. They come together to work on a well that has unique conditions. Depth of water, geologic condition, pressure, the technology that's going to be used, a lot of things that are unique to that situation. In a safety case regulatory approach, the companies come together to develop an operating plan to manage risk associated with that particular incident, that well, with those conditions, with those companies. That's very different than what we do. With a prescriptive management approach, it's more along the lines of how many fire extinguishers do you have? Check the box. How many times have you run your drilling fluids? Check the box. It's a very different approach. And we could go longer into it, but the Commission became convinced that the United States should move toward the safety case approach if we really want to be better at managing risk in high-risk situations. I might also note that, Norway's different in a lot of ways. Can we take just a moment on Norway? It's on everybody's mind these days. Population of 4.9 million people, very high quality of living, second only to Luxembourg in terms of GDP in Europe. Their permanent fund has $555 billion. I'll say that again, $555 billion in their two funds. We have $40 billion. It's quite remarkable. They have the highest petrol cost per liter in Europe and the lowest electricity cost. That's intentional. They use hydroelectricity. They want to drive people to use electricity. They sell their oil and gas instead of using their oil and gas at a subsidized rate. They have a very different approach to life. Statoil, one of their largest oil companies, is majority owned by government. But they are open for business. They have a vibrant private sector economy. They're a very diversified economy, fishing, tourism, etc. But they have a very different approach to business. It's much less hostile, but it's also much more controlled. So a lot of the antagonism that we feel in our country between the regulator and the person and the company regulated, they have a much different approach. So there's much more of an acceptance of government telling business how to do certain things. There's less antagonism about that, but they have a vibrant economy. So let's just say that there are a lot of things that are different. So it's not like we can just turn to Norway and say we're going to do it that way. That is completely unrealistic for a lot of reasons. But there are things about the way in which they do business that I think we can learn. I was in Norway last month for a large conference on the topic of oil and gas development in the Arctic. I was asked to speak about the BP Oil Spill Commission. The Norwegian Petroleum Directorate, which is sort of like our Department of Interior, the portion of it that actually manages natural resources, Brent Island spoke. What I found really interesting about her presentation was how similar their oil curve looks to ours. They've had a lot of development, that's the gray side, and in terms of what they are anticipating, both from the standpoint of known reserves and also hoped for reserves, they clearly are very interested in finding new fields, but they have a very sophisticated approach to how they decide which new fields are appropriate versus which areas will be protected for fisheries, for tourism. And they decide ahead of time. So instead of leasing an area and then doing the sophisticated environmental assessment after somebody's already got a lease, they do it ahead of time. So there's a lot of difference in terms of what the frustration that Americans sometimes feel and companies doing business in America sometimes feel about the gotcha phenomenon. They do it ahead of time. We're very resistant to things like marine spatial planning, but that's really what Norway does, and it gives more predictability in terms of how things get done. I don't really have time to go into the details, but they're looking further and further north just as we are and discussing the things that they will need to do to be able to move further north, both from the standpoint of technology that the industry uses, but also from the standpoint of how they deal with the big challenges like logistics and darkness and ice and remoteness and the environment and the other things that we're very concerned about here. The Petroleum Safety Authority is completely separated from the previous Natural Resources Development Authority. So that is one of the recommendations that the Commission made for us, for the Department of Interior. It's one of the things that happened when MMS went away and the Bureau of Energy and Management was created by Secretary Salazar and by the President. That is the approach that Norway uses, with a safety institute being completely separate and with that being their principal focus. Now, I know you can't read that, and I'm really sorry, but a professor at Boston University has done a really interesting paper about the differences between the Norwegian regulatory approach and the U.S. regulatory approach. And for those of you who are really interested in this, I can give you the website later, or you can just Google it at Boston University School of Law. But in a nutshell, it is as I've described it, which is they have an approach that manages risk. They separate out who does the development and deciding where you can develop from who is concerned about safety and managing risk. And they have an approach that basically views industry as being a responsible partner that can actually initiate the kind of technologies associated with improved business practices and holds them to that standard. And if they can't meet that standard, they can't do business in Norway. So, what about BP Oil Spill Commission results and our recommendations? We made recommendations for all of those entities because federal agencies, Congress, and industry all have an important role to play. And we also made some recommendations about how to improve response, restoration of the Gulf, future development, including the Arctic. So let's start with federal agencies. We suggested that old MMS get divided into three pieces. That has happened. The Obama administration did that administratively. We would prefer that Congress validate that by passing legislation that makes that permanent, but at least it is happening now, and that's important. So the leasing piece is different from the safety piece, which is different from those who collect the revenues. We also, as I mentioned before, suggested migrating toward a safety case management for improved risk management, and talk a bit about how important it is that we develop as a nation, that we take the lead and work with other nations about international best practices, both for the technology of OCS development, but also for oil spill response containment as well. Because most of these companies, of course, do business in all of these places. You know, the Shells, the BPs, the Statoils, they're doing business in all of these countries. And so having the movement toward best practices in standards, operating procedures, and for that matter, regulations for the long term makes sense for them as well as for everyone. Our recommendations for Congress, everything from sort of validating and making more permanent the new structure of the Department of Interior, also providing fees, because if you don't have a revenue source to provide the kind of regulation that keeps pace with the technologically advanced industry, it's really hard to have the kind of credibility that the regulators need to work as partners with industry. Again, that's sort of the Norwegian approach. It's what we need to do. If you can't pay your Department of Interior employees well enough to keep those engineers on board, you're going to lose them to industry, and you won't have the kind of expertise in-house that you need to really be a responsible regulator. So obviously they need funding, and Congress is about funding. It's not about funding right now, but it is, if you're thinking long-term as opposed to simply short-term, it's important for OCS development. We also recommend that Congress increase the oil spill liability cap. It's still set at $75 million. Some of you may remember that it got set at $75 million a long time ago. That was part of the Oil Pollution Act of 1990 that was a response to the Exxon Valdez oil spill. It hasn't been changed since. Obviously, it's inadequate if you look at the kind of billions of dollars that have already been spent in the Gulf. It's inadequate. We make a number of recommendations, but I do want to emphasize the last one, dedicating 80% of the Clean Water Act penalties to restore the Gulf of Mexico. The Gulf of Mexico was a rather severely compromised ecosystem even before this oil spill, for a variety of reasons that we don't have time to go into today. The disappearance of wetlands, the storm damage, oil and gas, et cetera. There've been for many, many years an awareness of the need to do something about the Gulf of Mexico, which is failing environmentally as an ecosystem. And it's a pretty vital piece of America's coastline. It's important for seafood and the people who live in the region, but it's also important in terms of maintaining the viability of the mouth of the Mississippi River. I'm just going to say that again, because we live here, we don't live there, and we don't think about it. But the Mississippi River is a gigantic transportation corridor for the entire Midwest, and actually for a lot of the United States. And the mouth of the Mississippi River, which is very important for that commercial transportation, is in peril because of the damage to the wetlands of the Gulf of Mexico. And again, that's a whole nother lecture, but let me just say that we have a national interest in restoring the Gulf of Mexico to health, restoring those wetlands, and keeping the mouth of the Mississippi River viable as a transportation corridor for the next 100 years. So we recommend penalties, and I do want to note, not just because David Ramser's in the room, but both Senator Begich and Senator Murkowski have been working with members of the Senate who are very interested in how we can restore the Gulf of Mexico, working on the combination of interests that Alaska and Louisiana have in common. And just let's remind ourselves of that. Alaska and Louisiana are a lot alike. Oil and gas, fishing, tourism, unique cultures, subsistence. You know, we have a lot in common. Our geography may look a heck of a lot different, but our economies and our societies have a lot in common. So they have been working on these things. I mean, the good news is there's still discussions underway. The bad news is Congress has not acted in ways that they need to be able to have us feel as though we have actually made some change happen, made some progress, learned from this accident. Frankly, in the way in which we learned from the Exxon Valdez oil spill. Let's remember, Exxon Valdez oil spill happens. What does Congress do? Pass OPA 90. Require the double-hull tankers. Require escort vehicles in and out of Prince William Sound. Create the regional citizens advisory councils in the Prince William Sound and in Cook Inlet. Create a requirement for ongoing depots of oil spill response capacity and training. A lot happened here after that tragedy. A lot needs to happen and hasn't yet as a result of this tragedy. We also make recommendations to industry that industry create a separate and independent safety institute that will focus on best practices for industry and be a way of creating peer pressure for the folks in the industry, frankly, who are leaders and who take safety very seriously, to be able to help everybody else get up to that same level. And I'm happy to say that the Petroleum Institute of America has created a safety institute within the last month. They created a separate safety institute. We had hoped that it might be separate and completely independent so that it wouldn't be kind of potentially confused with the Petroleum Institute of America's, you know, lobbying and other responsibilities. But at any rate, it's progress in creating and adopting the culture of safety that really is an important piece of our continuing to have confidence in what the industry and what government is doing. More on that if we had time, but I think we'll just move on. Again, response and containment, I think we all had the opportunity to watch on television day after day the frustration that the people of the Gulf had with the response to the spill. I would just say personally, I was impressed. I went down to HOMA, I went to the response and the main center, the folks in HOMA that were really working, I thought, very well. The folks working with BP and the Coast Guard, a lot of volunteers, a lot of people who dropped everything else they were doing and went to work together as a team. At one point, there were like 50,000 people responding to the spill. And it was pretty interesting to see how many Alaskans I ran into when I was in the Gulf. Alaskans from the folks who had actually worked on the Exxon Valdez oil spill. There were people with our oil spill expertise that were down there helping. People from our Coast Guard, from BP, from other members of the oil and gas industry, from our communities, from Prince William Sound communities, from the Prince William Sound Community College that does training for oil spill. Lots of Alaskans were down there helping. And frankly, given the nature of the spill, the size of the spill, the incredibly dispersed way in which the oil would show up, it didn't all show up on one shoreline, you know, sort of the way it did here in the Exxon Valdez incident. It was all over the place, and every day it would be different, and they had spotters and helicopters. It was like, you know, a war. It was a war. That really was what it was. There was a lot of frustration about how it was done, and there probably could have been a lot of things done better. Again, 2020 hindsight. But there was a remarkable effort made. And some of the things worked, some of the things didn't work. The message is we can be better prepared and learn from this. And there are a lot of things underway, both from the standpoint of spill response and containment. As you may know, the industry has stood up a containment corporation and has been building a mechanism that would be available for the Gulf of Mexico to be rolled in if there is an accident, to be able to more adequately contain a spill. So movement is being made. I do not mean by any means in my comments today to suggest that there aren't things that are happening that are in a way a lesson learned, yes. And that's great, but a lot more needs to be done. So let's talk briefly about the future before I open this up to questions. It wasn't really our mandate to talk specifically about either regions or specific technologies or make recommendations about where to go or where not to go. But obviously, the part of our mission, which was, you know, how can we do better in the future, made us take a moment to reflect upon the fact that as we project out over the next couple of decades, the vast majority of oil and gas, if you see the red states, that I guess that's the coastal areas that are the darkest in color, are those with the most potential. So as you can see, you know, the Gulf of Mexico still has a lot of potential. It's in deeper and deeper water, but a lot of potential remains, and potentially portions of the New England area, California, obviously the Arctic. So when we talked about the Arctic, and there was a lot of interest in the Arctic, we frankly got a lot of testimony about the Arctic on all sides of the question, which will come as no surprise to you as Alaskans. We were not in the position, and we did not feel it was appropriate for us to pass judgment on specific proposals that are on the table. We don't have either the time, the expertise, or the mandate. But we did lay out some of the things that we thought would be very important as we, as a nation, move forward in the Arctic. And that is pretty obvious, and I know many of you have thought about these things before. But we clearly need to improve our capacity for the Coast Guard to be able to do a lot of things in the Arctic, not just to respond to an oil spill, God forbid, but for search and rescue, for being able to respond for tourists. I mean, obviously, more and more tourism, more and more navigation, more and more commercial traffic is anticipated. And it's frankly an embarrassment to me that the United States has not made the kind of investment that it needs to make in the Coast Guard to be able to be ready for what we can see coming with the retreat of the ice and the warming of the Arctic. Similarly, being able to assure that we have sufficient scientific knowledge and understanding of the ecosystem, not only for purposes of making better choices about where the development takes place and under what conditions, what time of the year, how to buffer against important species that are used for subsistence, etc. But again, it's not to say that there hasn't been a lot of science. It's just that, frankly, it has been very regionalized and very species-specific and not integrated into what one could really describe as a comprehensive system. I want to acknowledge that there have been efforts in the last few years, particularly by the companies doing business in Alaska, to try to align their research efforts to combine them in a way that would make sense, make better sense of the research that exists. Similarly, an effort has been made by USGS, tasked by the administration, to do an assessment of what exists by way of scientific understanding in the Arctic, what research has already been done, and where are the science gaps. So this is not taking a blank piece of paper and writing on it. It's acknowledging that there is a lot that has been done, but it's also putting a shining spotlight on the fact that if we as a nation want to move forward in the Arctic as safely as possible, we have work to do. And that is what we tried to draw attention to. Again, I might note that for those of you who are interested in a deeper dive into the deep water, go to the oilspillcommission.gov. Oilspillcommission.gov, again, has the full report, including in great detail what went wrong on the rig, what happened. It's a gripping story, actually. It has a lot more about the recommendations, and it has the staff papers that were basically back up to the work that the commission was done. So on that note, I will say thank you very much for coming today, and if you have questions, I'll be happy to take a few.
Thank you, Fran. This is a backdoor question. Did they, as you talked to the various contractors, were they willing to accept responsibility? Say, you know, I understand, you know, I could have done a better job. What was their attitude? I know there's a liability issue floating out there, so that would temper their discussion. But when you talk to them afterwards.
There were a lot of off-the-record conversations. And a lot of off-the-record conversations, not only for the reason that you mentioned that there are a lot of lawsuits out there, and obviously that's something everybody has to think about, but also because we never got the subpoena power that we had asked for. The president asked Congress to give us subpoena power. We never got it. And so we had to rely on people who were willing to go on the record, who felt that they could without exposing for purposes of litigation, and people who were willing to talk off the record, and people with whom we had an understanding that they would share information if we did not attribute it. So this report is based on, frankly, a lot of cooperation from the industry, because a lot of people in the industry wanted us to be able to dig more deeply in understanding what went wrong so that it wouldn't go wrong again. I mean, industry has as much of an interest in safe operating practices any of us do. But let's remember, the oil and gas industry is not some monolithic thing. It's big and it's small. It's international, it's regional. It's young startups, it's ancient, it's lots of contractors and subcontractors and support industry. I mean, it's many things. So trying to speak about it in, you know, in a simple way is a hard thing to do. But yes, there were people who said, we are really sorry. We're sorry for whatever role we played. We're sorry for the complacency. We're sorry for the hard time we gave MMS over asking us to do a better job on oil spill response plans. Remember that business about walruses in the oil spill response plan? Remember, this was got a lot of press about how could you possibly have a walrus in an oil spill response plan that had been, you know, submitted and approved? Complacency. You know, frankly, rubber stamping, getting used to it, thinking that nobody's going to care, thinking it's never going to happen, thinking that you don't really have to think seriously about what's going on. And believe me, this was not just BP. Now, that's been a big issue. You know, was this a one-time event? Was it just a black swan? Was it just... No. And again, as we pressed and had conversations with industry, publicly they rejected that concept completely and said it was a one-time event. But if you look at the 79 uncontrolled gas escape near misses in a 10-year period of time in the Gulf of Mexico, it's pretty hard to walk away from that conclusion. If you look at the fact that we have four times the fatality rate in the Gulf of Mexico than in the North Sea, it's kind of hard to walk away from the, you know, with the conclusion that it's a slightly broader problem and everybody should care about improving the system.
Thank you. The blowout preventers have been proven not to work, and yet we're continuing to do more leases in the Gulf. What is the status of the improvement of the blowout preventer, and why are we still doing leases?
Blowout preventers are the last line of defense. They are not the strategy from keeping oil spills from happening. And I just want to say that. There was a lot of, again, I don't know if there's any media in the room today, but, you know, the media often goes to, you know, the thing that they can talk about, and they talked a lot about the blowout preventer. Now, that's an important piece of equipment, but if you're driving your car and you run into a tree and your airbag doesn't go off, you know, you're more likely to actually end up dying. But your car did not run into the tree because your airbag didn't go off, if you see what I mean. So you prevent these kinds of accidents with a lot of steps that protect against an unintended blowout. That is the last possible step in the process. So improving risk management, assuring that if a team sees a failed negative pressure test as they are doing a temporary abandonment of a well, and the negative pressure test on the Deepwater Horizon rig failed three times, and yet they still went forward with shutting it down when they changed the parameters of the test, and then it worked out okay, and then they went for never should have continued when there were three negative pressure test failures. So, I mean, all of those things are supposed to happen way before you rely on a blowout preventer as the final step. So I think I don't want to speak for the Department of Interior, but I think the Department of Interior is issuing leases, permits, the companies are moving forward with an increased scrutiny of those other steps that are supposed to keep these things from happening, understanding that blowout preventers need work. Now, there's a lot of technology associated with a blowout preventer, why this one failed in terms of the bent pipe, and, you know, there's a lot of argument, and there will be more argument in the lawsuit about why and how and if, but there's no doubt that we have, back to the complacency point, been willing, we test the effectiveness of blowout preventers in non-emergency environments. So there's a lot we don't know, frankly, about their ability to actually, particularly on the kind of high volume flow that was happening on that particular rig. So do I think they are completely, you know, good to go? I don't have enough information to pass judgment on that. Should we be relying on that as the judgment call as to whether or not we should allow permits to get issued? No, because we need the oil. The country needs the oil. The companies need the oil. The oil and gas states that, are clamoring for more permits to be issued faster, not for slowing it down and being more cautious. So there are lots of moving parts here, but I think Interior is saying to the companies doing business, we want to know more about your risk management plan. We're not just going to rely on blowout preventers as the thing that makes us either feel comfortable or not about moving forward. Other questions?
Thank you, Fran, for a very good explanation. And I think you're owed an extra round of applause for your service to the country and the state on the commission.
Thank you. Thanks.
Although, all this good work that you did, also from our parochial point of view here, put us all into a great fright that development of oil in the north of Alaska would be put on hold. And indeed, that seems to be a lot of what has happened. And I looked at your explanation of the Arctic, and I thought, oh dear, there's a lot of delay in there. And a lot of it, in particular, is on the government side, because you're making recommendations about increased Coast Guard activity, which, to the best of my knowledge, requires appropriations. And you say the Congress has not been as forthcoming as you might have hoped on these things. And I'm wondering what message of hope you can give to us on moving forward a little bit more rapidly in the development of the Chukchi and the Beaufort.
If you read the two or three pages about the Arctic in our report, you will find language that specifically says that our recommendations about the Arctic should not be interpreted as a de facto moratorium on Arctic development. And that was something that we spent a lot of time as a commission talking about. We decided we were not comfortable saying there shouldn't be any development at all in the Arctic until these things happen. So that's why we used the language when we said, this is not a de facto moratorium on moving forward in the Arctic. It is rather our way of shining a spotlight on what we think is responsible for both Congress and the industry to pay attention to. It's not our judgment about the timing. It's not our judgment about the adequacy. It's simply our ability to say, if you're asking us for what recommendations we make about how we can be better prepared to deal with risk and have safer operations, we need to get busy. We need to not be complacent. We need to recognize that there are huge differences about doing business in the Gulf of Mexico and doing business in the Arctic. Some better, some worse, some harder, some easier. They're just really different. And what we were trying to do is simply say, the United States, don't assume that it's good enough to simply do business as usual. Get on with it and make the investments necessary. Now, how long it takes Congress to act, how long it takes the Coast Guard to redeploy some of their resources, how long it takes industry and government working together to do the kind of preparation, it's not for either me or, frankly, the commission to judge. But we did feel it was important to put in there both statements. One, we need to get busy. Two, this is not a de facto moratorium. So that's, I don't know that that's what you're looking for, but that's sort of an explanation of how the commission was able to come up with a unanimous decision. Because we had people on the commission who both wanted to say, let's pass judgment very specifically on some of the Shell permits. And we had other people who said, we ought to have a moratorium. There never should be. Matter of fact, not just not now, but never. So we had the full range on the commission, and this was our compromise, which I personally feel comfortable with because I think it's true. I think it is true that we have an obligation as people who live in a pretty special place to say, you know what? We love this place. We don't want it to be locked up forever, but we also don't want to be cavalier about the risks, and we want to be prepared. So let's all call up Senator Murkowski and Senator Begich and Congressman Young and anybody else we know in Washington, D.C. and say, what's up? Let's get on with it.
Well, you kind of have answered my question to a degree. First of all, I want to say I think you're a remarkable person. You don't seem to have any hidden agendas. You're here for the good of all, and I really appreciate that. And my question was going to be, what can I as a commoner do in this day of royalty to help try to spur this on at the congressional level? I know we have three people in Congress, but are there others that we won't be there, the people that elect them, but how about other officials that we can contact? What can we do as a people to help try to move this along in the government?
Well, commissioners asked themselves that same question, because when we delivered our report to the president in January, we were over. I mean, we're done. We don't exist anymore. But we asked ourselves, after having spent 6 months learning what we learned and feeling this sense of commitment, that we don't do it as good as we could do it. And we ought to be the best in the world, and we're not. And why have we come to this place where we're willing to simply say, you know, don't worry about it? I don't know. We've become, as a nation, perhaps just a little too complacent. I don't know what else to say about it. So why could we amass the kind of will after the Exxon Valdez oil spill to make the changes that were made? Why can't we do that now? What's so different? I don't know. I mean, the Gulf of Mexico was spilled with something like, I don't know, 15 times more oil got spilled than the Exxon Valdez spill, something like that, maybe 19 more. I can't remember what the numbers were. Why is that? I don't really know. Is it because we're afraid, because of our economy, because we're afraid somehow that, you know, if we have a different kind of regulatory regime? I'm not saying more, I'm saying different. Safer, that somehow that's going to be bad for the economy? Gee, do you think that what happened in the Gulf of Mexico was good for the economy? You know, don't we want to prevent that from happening? So why can't we get ourselves charged up enough to give enough political support to our elected leaders to do some of the things that need to be done? I wish I knew the answer to that question. I used to have answers for questions like that. When I was younger, I had lots of answers that I don't have anymore, you know? You know, if you blog, you know, if you talk to talk radio, if you write letters, do emails, I don't really know. I do know that it's really important that we are a little more open in our minds to how we do business so that we can continual improvement. You know, companies do that. Companies are about continual improvement. The oil and gas development that has taken place in the Gulf of Mexico in, you know, 7,000 feet of water, 10,000 feet of water, that's about companies choosing to constantly be looking for new technologies that will allow them to drill deeper and more challenging conditions. I mean, they do it. Why, as a country, as a government, can't we do it? Why do we feel so much like, well, however it's been done is the way it's going to be done? We need to make change. We need to do things that are politically difficult, like the liability limit. I don't know. I think perhaps just not feeling as though somebody else is doing it for us is the answer. Maybe that is the answer, instead of feeling as though it's somebody else's job. It's all of our jobs. The commission agreed that a year from the date of when we completed our report, we would get together and do a report card. So we're going to do a report card next January. A report card on Congress, a report card on the industry, a report card on the federal agencies. We're going to do a report card. Okay, so this is what we recommended. How'd you guys do? And, you know, try to get some media. We'll do little things like that, but generally speaking, I think it's individuals being who care enough about it to letting their voice be heard, and hopefully that will add up.
Thank you, Fran, for a great talk. In some of the earlier discussions of the before the final recommendations came out, there were references to learning from the nuclear industry, and I don't see anything in your presentation about that.
You would, if you heard the 2-hour version, you would. The piece that I did about the recommendations for industry and setting up its own separate, privately run safety institute is shorthand for what we said in the report. In the report, we talk a lot about there are a lot of high-risk industries, the airline industry, the nuclear industry, et cetera, and they do things in a way that increases safety for everybody. The nuclear industry, they have a completely separate, privately operated by nuclear operators themselves, industry-led institute that inspects the nuclear operators and grades them, and then the nuclear operators pay an insurance rate based on their grade. Do you think that matters to them? Yes, it matters to them. So you've got it's not the only way in which nuclear operators are regulated. There's also a federal agency that regulates them, but this is the private sector regulating itself in a way by saying it's not good enough to be average, you have to be excellent. And that's what the nuclear industry does. And yes, we talk in the report a lot about how we challenge the oil and gas industry to think about how peer pressure could be a way of lifting all of the boats, and that if there was a system by which they could share best practices, technology innovations, grade each other. You know, obviously, like I said before, the industry is complicated, it's complex, it's diverse, so it's not as simple as the way in which the nuclear operators can do their business. It would have to be adapted in some way, and I hope it will be. I hope they figure that out. Because it's powerful. It's actually one of the things we talk about with regard to the Arctic. A lot of Arctic nations are going to be drilling for oil. It's not just Alaska. Obviously, it's Russia, it's Greenland, it's Canada, it's Norway. And so some of the challenges that exist in the North are common. Some of them are different. But using best practices, setting international standards, we think the United States ought to be a leader in developing and establishing international standards for Arctic oil and gas development. Back to your question, John, about is there a glimmer of hope? It's happening. It is. The Arctic Council and other entities are talking about these best practices that will make it safer for the long term for industry and for the environment. So there are important ways that industry can lead, and some of the companies are, but you need some sort of mechanism to get others that aren't on board.
I would like to just mention that I was in Norway about a year ago. It is obvious that the Norwegian people receive a lot more for their oil than, for instance, we do. They have a fully developed road system equivalent from Seattle to Anchorage. They have bridges to nowhere by the dozen. We don't manage one. And I believe it is a large extent because the treasures in the ground, the oil and whatever, belongs to the government, and they manage it for the people. Here, these industries are managed by private individuals, private companies, international in nature. They only have one purpose, and that's their profit. In Norway, the people observing as a tourist there seem to be doing, the working people seem to do better than we do. Wouldn't it be about time that we do some rethinking about the mining laws of the 1800s that gave individuals and corporations the right to all this public good?
Well, that's not a question that the Commission addressed. and yeah. And I've been to Norway four or five times over my life, and there are some things that are very appealing about Norway. They have a very high standard of living. They have a very secure safety net, you know, free health care, free education, free child care, free elder care, high taxes. They do have a lot of infrastructure. They invested heavily in hydroelectricity early on. You know, they've made a lot of good choices. When oil came rolling in the early 90s, they did not get rid of their personal income tax the way Alaska did. They said, you know, the current generation ought to pay for services too and not get everything free. We went a very different route, you know. I mean, there are a lot of differences, and sometime over a beer, I'd be happy to talk to you about it.
We have time for one more question. I guess that's me. I'm talking about the issue and perhaps the contrast, if you would, between the, as I know, certainly BP is spending quite a bit of money doing what it's called process safety, and contrasting that with the Norwegian safety case scenario. Are they different? Are they close to the same?
Process safety is part of what you would build into a safety case associated with a particular rig. So, I mean, there's worker safety, there's environmental safety, there's technology safety. I mean, all of those things get built into the safety case that gets built around a particular well and a particular rig. And yes, process safety is a piece of a big chunk of a lot of different industries. It's a piece of what gets talked about in terms of a safety case. And yes, I don't want anybody to walk away thinking that I don't acknowledge, that we didn't acknowledge, that there are a lot of good things that industry does. And they care about things like, they care about the same things we all care about. They don't want fires. They don't want deaths on rigs. They don't want accidents. And yet, we haven't evolved yet in a way that manages risks effectively. And I'm simply saying, I mean, it's a high-risk industry, just like a lot of other high-risk industries. You will never completely get rid of risk. But you can manage it, and you can reduce it, and you can have a culture in which everything that you do, both the companies and the government, are more focused on that than we have been. That's basically our message, and there are ways in which we can work toward achieving that in a way that systematizes what we do so that we can reduce some of the risks that we have. Looks like there's one last question, and then we'll call it a day.
Thanks. My question is, I guess, trying to bring it back to take this and make it applicable for Alaska, and given that you said that it's not an issue of likelihood and that there actually have been many blowouts, just not to the same severity as the one that you were talking about, and that there's clearly risk involved and that it's a high-risk industry. I was curious about the fact that you said at the mouth of the Mississippi River how that is such an intimate link between ecosystem and nature and commerce and trade. And I feel like that gets a little bit glossed over a lot in a lot of discussions about things like drilling and whatnot. And I guess for Alaska, whereas there's not a major hub of trade up on the North Slope necessarily, what kind of connection is there up there between the ecosystem and the commerce or the potential for commerce in the future as more trade starts to happen up there? Is there a higher risk factor for Alaska and the North Slope than might at first appear that there is?
So after I've been on the U.S. Arctic Research Commission for a year, can I come back and talk about that? I don't mean to completely avoid the question, but I mean, it's complicated because right now, much of what happens, I mean, there's a lot of oil and gas development on the North Slope, but most of it's on shore, and what's not on shore is on gravel islands, and very little of it is in, I mean, it's not platforms, the way platforms are being developed in the Gulf of Mexico or the way in which they will be in the Beaufort, the Chukchi, and how that relates to both the ecosystem, the environmental protection technologies that we might use, the relationship between the subsistence use, the migration of whales, all of those things. This is another lecture, but I appreciate the question and the sensitivity of the fact that we need to care about that. Just as people in Alaska tend not to think a lot about the mouth of the Mississippi, actually people sitting in Anchorage tend to think not all that very much about the Beaufort or the Chukchi, except as a potential for additional oil and gas development that might benefit them economically. And that's a legitimate interest, but it's not the only interest that matters in Alaska, and certainly not to the people who live on the North Slope, who have a variety of interests in what happens in their backyard. So by way of closing, let me just say again, please go visit the spill if you are interested in knowing more. I apologize for some of the things that I have really glossed over in my presentation today. And I do want to acknowledge that the university was very generous in allowing my time to be spent as a commissioner while I was still being chancellor. But I'm really glad I got to do it. I was the only Alaskan on the commission, and I felt it was really helpful, not just for the other commissioners to hear about things from Alaska, particularly because we talked about the Arctic, Because there were so many Alaskans who had things to contribute. Many people in this state, people who had done research, people who were involved in oil spill response, former mayors from the Prince William Sound area who were there on the front lines during the Exxon Valdez, who gave assistance and emotional support to current mayors in the Gulf of Mexico. And to the extent that I could help link those people up, I felt as though it was an important thing for an Alaskan to do, and I just feel really fortunate that I had the opportunity. Thanks again for being here today.
I'd like to thank Franna Ulmer not only for speaking to us today, but right before this, she went to West High School and spoke to a room full of International Baccalaureate students on the same topic and was very well received. And as you go back and forth to Washington, D.C., we'd like to give you a little momentum of Alaska World Affairs Council travel mug and some magnet.
Thank you.
Come back. Our next program will be on Friday, the 13th of May, so not next Friday, but the following Friday, and we will be featuring Peter Probst, who is with the Institute for the Study of Terrorism and Political Violence, and he will be speaking to us on Target America, Radical Islam and the Muslim Brotherhood. This will be here upstairs. Doors will open at 11:30. Please send in your RSVP and look for our Ambassador Series, which will be beginning in June. Thank you.
Here. Hi. Hi, Pat.